We fundamentally are misdefining life to talk about a work and life balance. I think work is part of our life.
Welcome to Acton Line, a product of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. I'm Eric Cohn, executive producer. In this episode, we're bringing you a conversation from our recent Business Matters virtual conference, where I talk with David Bahnsen about his new book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life. In his book, Bahnsen makes the case that our understanding of work and its role in our lives is deeply flawed. We are unmoored from what he calls created purpose. He argues that the time has come to stop tiptoeing around the issues that matter, that separating one's identity from what they do is demonstrably false, and that this era of alienation is for many a direct result of a low view of work. It is in work, effort, service, striving, of every kind, that we discover our meaning and purpose. A significant and successful life is one rooted in full-time productivity and cultivation of God's created world. Business Matters is the Acton Institute's premier virtual conference on business, ethics, and faith. You can watch all the sessions from this year's Business Matters conference, as well as sessions from previous year's conferences, at Acton On Demand by going to ondemand.acton.org. We'll put a link in the show notes for this episode where you can sign up and access Acton On Demand. You can find additional resources in the show notes for this episode, as well as find previous episodes of Acton Line on our website at acton.org/actonline. And if you like this program, you can help us reach even more listeners by sharing it with a friend and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We welcome your comments as well. Acton Line is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. I'm excited now to welcome David Bahnsen, the founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Bahnsen Group, a national private wealth management firm. David is also the newest member of Acton Institute's board of directors and the author of the new book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life. David, why don't we start with, tell me what your book's about.
Well, obviously the subtitle gives away that I am writing a very pro-work message here. The intent is to talk about our need, particularly for the believing community, those of the Christian faith, to view work as something more than just a necessary evil, something that is required to be done so we can make a living, something that is, in fact, core to our identity as believers. And so the book is really intended to be kind of a hard-hitting call, not only to believers, those in the pews, but to ministers as well, to begin reclaiming a message from the pulpits that is vigorously pro-work, to kind of lean away from the general defensiveness and even skepticism that I think has become embedded in much of Christian theology about work that tends to view it in a utilitarian construct, something that is done only to the extent that it can serve another aim, an aim that is actually superior spiritually. I think there's a lot of closet dualism that is kicked in around work that views it as a sort of secular act and maybe can be done to reclaim a certain sacred virtue, but is nevertheless not itself sacred. I think it's an anti-Christian message. And the book is meant to be a sort of vigorous call for us to reclaim a theology of work, something that I think Christians have historically done very well, that we've gotten away from over this last 50 years.
Where did that wrong understanding by your lights of work come from? How did it get instantiated into the teaching of certain churches?
What's interesting is that I suspect there's a different answer to that in the Catholic tradition versus the Protestant tradition. And I think both are worth unpacking. And yet I have a little more familiarity and expertise on the Protestant side. So that's really more where the book focuses, although I lean heavily on some of the great contributions in Catholic thought, including from Pope John Paul the Great, around work that I think is meaningful to Christians of all traditions and backgrounds. But in Protestantism, I don't think there's any question that it's come from a 20th century evangelicalism that became very retreatist, that became afraid of modernity, that largely surrendered to forces of liberalism, Darwinism, and certainly what they viewed as the kind of enemy of modernity. I think the Protestantism overall became more anti-intellectual. It certainly became more anti-vigorous in terms of its theological precision, but it also became way less focused on anything that had earthly significance, and work would be at the top of that list. I don't know that it entirely came about only as a matter of intellectual failure. I think a lot of it is just pure failure of practice, of piety, that walking away from these obligations went hand in hand with increased compromise in the world. The notion of having a strong sense of dominion, a strong sense of cultural stewardship, that all goes hand in hand with what I consider to be original Protestant thought, certainly in the Calvinist tradition, the Kuyperian tradition that I come from, and as evangelicalism weakened throughout the 20th century, I think its theology of vocation significantly weakened.
So, David, the first chapter of your book is A Crisis of Despair, and subheaded here, Dignity and Earned Success. Unpack that despair, because I think that's a description of the, I guess, emotional state of a lot right now, that, you know, we talk about crises in crisis of despair in terms of particularly men without work. I interviewed Nick Eberstadt from AEI on his work on that. We talk about crisis of despair in terms of substance abuse and the way that even Yuval Levin in pointing out that, you know, certain problems that conservatives, people coming from the right, would be celebratory of. There's kind of a dark cloud to those silver linings. And one of the ways I remember in the piece him making this point is, you know, people choose drugs now, opiates that cause them to withdraw and drop out of society, in contrast to the problematic, to be clear, use of something like cocaine in the 1980s that caused people to go, go, go. You know, there's this sense of despair being omnipresent. How are you seeing that manifest itself in the world of work?
Well, I think that the retreat from work is a cause of the despair. And then, like most things in life, you're either creating a positive or a negative feedback loop. And that what has happened is a lost purpose, a lost telos that comes from a low view of work and vocation leads to despair, which leads to a state of mind, morally, physically, mentally, psychologically, intellectually, that makes one less employable and then leads to one being even more in despair. And so these things feed on themselves. The irony here is that the world's message right now, and often a message from pulpits, is that work is part of the problem of despair. The people are too stressed, or they're working too much, or there's too many deadlines, that what the need of the hour is more relief from work, and that then we would have less despair. Now, of course, the data doesn't play this out in any way, shape, or form. The vast majority of where we see real severe despair, and you rightly point out, it evidences itself in greater form of alcoholism, drug abuse, but on the most severe side, suicide. There's very often people that are untethered from a career, from even a job, and then also from other, and this is some of Yuval Levin's great work, institutions and civil society, primarily church and family. So I use Arthur Brooks's sort of four-pronged idea around a happy person, one generally speaking that has faith, family, friends, he says community, and then work. And my point I make in this chapter in the book is that we basically, as a society, agree on the first three. Now, it may seem as if the world is anti-faith, but they act as if they believe that it's a really noble thing to have some sort of nebulous sense of spirituality, some connection to something, even if they're no way going to come accept the Orthodox Christian faith as that solution. They don't act as if they're against some sort of transcendent belief system. Charles Murray, for over a decade now, has talked about how family is really quite celebrated outside of the Christian world. There's a sense in which, in our more affluent society, people celebrate some form of a family structure, and anti-family behaviors are considered anti-social. And then when you get to friends and community, I think that people have far less friends than they used to. We're doing a really poor job at solidifying what I consider to be a tight-knit community. Yet, nevertheless, when you look to people who have some form of functional, happy day-to-day life, even things like their yoga classes, spin classes, Starbucks's whole kind of business model to begin with was on people getting together and there being some sort of social interaction. It's work that is the controversial one. Work is the one where the constant, unending cultural message is that people work too hard and they need to work less. That there's people that are just lost the plot. They forgot about the small town. Hallmark, over the holiday season, will have 100 movies that come out, and all of them will be about someone, either male or female, who left the town to go this evil career thing, and then they've come back and remembered what's important in life, whether it's a small town or their family or an old girlfriend or boyfriend or something to that effect. But no matter what, Hollywood does a very good job of making the same movie hundreds of times, which is some form of demonization of careerism. And it's easy for the church to then follow on that. It already has a sentimental strand, and then you add into it language of idolatry and other things that are easy to spiritualize. We talk about work as if it's this overarching enemy. But yet my argument is, in a time of despair, back to your question, in a time of these isolations, alienations that clearly permeate society more so than they have in decades, I believe it's a lack of telos that is at the root. People being untethered from purpose. And the book is not heavy on breaking down the sort of sociological gender realities around this, but nevertheless, this is true that it's mostly found. It's mostly found in a declining zeal for work in men. And I make the statistical point you mentioned, Nick, and Eberstadt's work is just vital here. I quote it heavily throughout one of the chapters here of the book. We right now, if you count the people who have a job and or looking for a job as the labor force, we basically, across the total population of employed divided by available prime working age men, are at 82%. It's around the same level it was at the Great Depression. So the only reason why the unemployment itself is so much lower is we have so many people who have voluntarily removed themselves from the workforce, and they're not counting in the labor data. They're removed from that denominator. That statistic to me is horrifying, and I think it's a huge part of the explanation for this despair that we are talking about.
What role does technology, and particularly the internet, play in all of this? I want you to definitely touch on what we talked about last year for Business Matters, which is remote work. We focused pretty closely on that, but also talk about it in terms of some of the effects that the internet particularly has had on society, which is at a time where people are having fewer close relationships, close personal relationships. On the other hand, we have this, device that we can hold in our hand that makes someone on the other side of the earth feel as close to us as somebody who's next door. But that's not really the same thing. Like, we don't have the same kind of intimate personal connection. This has always been my point about Zoom conferencing, that it's like, it's a useful tool, but it weighs on our brains. I remember reading something early on in the pandemic about how it creates this something similar to the uncanny valley effect from science fiction, that it's supposed to seem human, but there's something not quite off on it, and it stresses our brains out. So that kind of democratization of human relationships, as it's been applied to work, you know, what role have these technological advances had, both, I guess, in, you know, changing the nature of work in a lot of good ways, but also exacerbating some of the problems that I think you've been pointing to?
Well, I think there's a couple of different categories there. When you talk about the use of technology at work, there is a sense in which some people may end up having less contact with coworkers than they previously would have because of technological advancements. I don't think that's systemic. I think for the most part, within the context of work, technology is largely used to create greater efficiencies. And yet real successful businesses do not allow it to disintermediate the normal relationships that one has to have with customers, with clients, with coworkers. And that is part of the critique I had a year ago about the work from home movement. And in fact, the appendix of my new book really, really hits this point even harder than I was a year ago. I become even more emphatic through time in my feelings about work from home. But I think what I would argue technology is done in this subject has to do with people who are not working, which is it gives people a substitute in activity that is not productive, and it does not scratch the itches of the human soul's need for companionship, for friendship, for interaction, for physical activity, and yet buys time. And extreme isolation usually comes from extreme idleness. And I think technology does just enough to dampen some of the idleness, but not anything to really meaningfully impact that isolation. And I'm always hesitant whenever any question starts with, you know, well, where do you think technology? I'm such an Ecclesiastes guy about nothing new under the sun. I always want to think about how this existed before. And that's really my argument. In a day and age of TikTok and Instagram, I fully acknowledge it's at light speed now. There's a million other options. The way in which this has exponentially moved as a result of a microprocessor is surreal. But I think television before the day and age of the internet also accomplished that. It enabled people to receive entertainment without human interaction. I'm sure there were people who felt the same way about the automobile, about a record player, about a radio. So
printing press. Yeah.
But it's accelerated in the speed. I think within a work context, technology should be used to do things more efficiently, which enables greater human interaction, not less. That ought to be the ideal. And then for the unemployed, technology should not be allowed to become a sort of saccharin that is just sweet enough that makes us feel like we're getting the real thing, but we're never quite getting it.
The fourth chapter of your book is entitled "The Sermon You'll Never Hear," and at the risk of asking you to do what in the subtitle of the chapter here, the whole Bible's message on work, I want to ask you to summarize the entire Bible for us, David. What is the point of that sermon that you say people will never hear on this message?
It's that God made us for the purpose of work. The intent in creation, God making us to be in communion with Him, and that we were made as image bearers of Him, and that from the outset, the very creation account, what we are told is that our purpose is differentiated from that of the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom and other parts of creation, and that when we receive our very good status, as opposed to the good status that the rest of creation had gotten day by day, that what we find is the unique attributes that we have being made in the image of God with dignity is in our capacity to work, to be creative, to be productive, to be innovative. So there's a very economic lesson that gets to the basics of anthropology that groups like the ACT Institute have taught so faithfully for so many years. When you apply that message of Christian anthropology and a creational theology to the subject of work, I think pastors are kind of left with a very inconvenient truth that work was a pre-fall creation that really is at the essence of what God made us for, and that the fall and the entrance of sin into the world no way polluted or took away from God's intent for us. And in fact, now, for one who believes in a sort of theology of redemption, I think God is using our work as part of his plan through history, redeeming these people back to himself, his people back to himself. Avodah, the Hebrew prefix with avo, repeated countless times throughout the scripture, that can be translated literally as to work, and in other cases is translated literally as to worship. And this is the same Hebrew word. And I think there's a profound significance in that, that the Bible sees work in the same context as worship, that this is us living out vocationally, but in the material realm, living out a very worship of God through our daily endeavors. And I do not believe that is a message that is preached from pulpits at all. So I'm giving you kind of a basic rundown of it. I try in that passage, to very exegetically address some of these passages that I think are often ignored in the scripture.
Talk to me about money. So I think this is where we were talking earlier about the different views on work and viewing it as a utilitarian exercise. To me, that speaks of this connection to, well, you need money to live, and so you got to work, and that's the way to get money. And I think this is also what has given rise, you know, over time to, you know, Marx and different interpretations of, you know, like, well, if we disconnect money from work and from the capitalist infrastructure, we can create something more meaningful for people. And we saw that didn't particularly pan out. But talk about money's role in this, and connect it back to what that we'd referenced with Arthur Brooks. And one of the things from him that's always stuck with me is the idea of earned success, that you can draw these contrasts between people who are high-powered lawyers making $300,000, $400,000 a year and are miserable, and people who are making far less than that, but feel that they are needed at the place where they work, and feel that they are performing something that is valued by people, and as a result have a higher level of fulfillment than people earning far much more money than them, but who lack that sense of fulfillment in the work they're doing.
So the way in which I address the money issue in the book there's kind of two really different questions in what you've presented. And the point Arthur Brooks talks about there, and just that general issue that I'm sure you and I would fully agree on, is that ultimately one's satisfaction from their work will not merely be defined by financial remuneration. And I completely agree, and I make the argument throughout the book that this idea that there are sort of special jobs, high profile, that are socially recognized. You know, you can go brag on a Friday night what you do, a high-powered lawyer. It has a certain strata that comes with it tied to economics. That comes as a direct result of us having a low regard for work. This whole idea that today an electrician and someone works with their hands and other forms of skilled labor are kind of lesser than, that didn't come about because of people like myself with my theology of work advocating for us all to look at white-collar workers as more elite or distinguished. It came about because the broad theological base went away, that we weren't defending vocational activity the way we would. My position is decidedly non-elitist and, in fact, anti-elitist, and is very much reinforced by the basic psychological reality that there are people who are doing what they feel called to do and enjoy doing that make much less than other people who are earning a lot more and are really quite unhappy. However, the point I make in the book about money is that I think there's a fair amount, I don't want to say a lot, but I think there's a fair amount of decent books out there about faith and work, about Christians having a higher theology of work than they've had. But I don't think any of them address money. And I quote quite fondly throughout the book, Every Good Endeavor, by my old friend, the late now Tim Keller, which I think is one of the greater books I've read on the subject, and I think I've read all of them. But Tim doesn't talk about money in the book. That wasn't really his focal point. And I try to get down to, look, okay, let's say we're on the same page. We've accepted that God made us to produce. We are here to cultivate this world, and our vocational callings matter to God. The worker is the subject, as Pope John Paul talked about, of work, and that there is an object out there that we are providing goods and services for. All of these things matter to God. And then you say, okay, but just when it comes down to it, you're already making a bunch of money, and is it okay or not to have as one of your ambitions to make more, to get that next promotion, that next corner office? And what I try to do in the book is just simply point out that the critics of a mentality of careerism or of ambition, of some sort of aspiration in what you're accomplishing, which does have a financial tie to it, that they're hardly neutral on the subject. That what people have largely done is get to a point of their own middle class comforts. And it could be upper middle class comforts, but it's some lifestyle that they've achieved that is now the baseline. And then the question becomes, what level of financial comfort is okay to work for above the line at which I'm at? That I think it is a highly pharisaical conversation, that ultimately we're not arguing from the vantage point of, is it okay to work for greater material well-being? We're arguing from the vantage point of, is it okay for someone to have greater material well-being than I have? And that we set a sort of baseline around our lifestyle and act as if anything above it's problematic. And I think that that is the wrong way to address the issue. So I try to recover a more Christian theology of wealth as well, that argues that every single thing, including wealth, that becomes an idol, is a problem, is sinful. The scripture is filled with thousands of warnings against. But that there is undeniable teaching in scripture that greater material prosperity is referred to as a blessing and a reward for hard work. And it shouldn't be so hard to reconcile these two biblical truths, idolatry bad, ambition good. It shouldn't be hard to reconcile them because God himself reconciled them throughout every page of scripture.
Your point about that, setting that baseline and then, you know, what is the relationship above that that other people can have, reminds me of this, you know, great video I imagine you've probably seen from Margaret Thatcher responding to some of her critics and saying that's like, you know, you would rather have people, the gap between the rich and the poor be narrow and down here and have everyone be less well off than having a larger gap, but everybody is better off than they would be otherwise.
And it sounds better in Lady Thatcher's British accent, but she said, yes, you'd rather the poor be poor just so long as the rich are not richer. And what I think is particularly upsetting, and again, my experience in this is more in evangelical circles, but I think there's this tremendous amount of upper middle class comfort in most of 20th century American evangelicalism. They are not, there are two cars, there are houses paid for, there are 401ks. People are living in a certain sense of what would historically be considered very nice material positions. And to then turn around and direct the message at, but I'm worried about your boat or your second home or your, these things rank a Phariseeism and are always starting from a vantage point that I think is really quite selective.
David, talk to me about retirement. So I'm captivated by the subhead of the chapter on that, rethinking the idea of a 30-year vacation, which appeals to me on its face as I've thought about, you know, as I've worked and put money into a retirement account and thinking about the way that that's typically understood, that you get to a certain point and you stop working. And, you know, my occupation, my vocation is idea work and the kind of thing like I would certainly want to still be engaging with these ideas and these things that I care about well past the government appointed retirement age. So I've never thought about it in terms of that. I just want to go off and play golf every day. I'd like to play more golf, to be sure. But not thinking of it in terms of you get to a point in life and people who...
Well, I wish that we had such a thing as a government-appointed age, because then I could just criticize government policy. But this is entirely of our own doing. This was a cultural, voluntary decision to create the idea of work as something you do so you don't have to do it anymore. And I point out that a lot of it is just demographic, that people were living about 10 years longer and then 20 years longer. And so lo and behold, you had the same time post-war America had the health and mortality that was enabling this idea and the economic well-being that really for the most of history, prior to post-war American prosperity, a retirement plan was called death. That's what people did. They died. And my view is not that we should not be saving for what they do call in the Madison Avenue approach to retirement in 1960s America and beyond, pension funds, 401k, IRAs. I've worked in financial services my entire career. I run a $5 billion wealth management firm. We talk about retirement accounts all the time, but the nomenclature is very upsetting to me. I want you to contribute to your retirement plan, but I sure hope you don't stop contributing to work at the Acton Institute or other organizations doing kingdom work, vocational work, calling. I want these financial accounts to be for a purpose of better freedom and convenience, but not an exit from usefulness. And first of all, I don't want the exit from usefulness because I care about the person not becoming useless, losing their dignity, losing their God-given abilities, but I also selfishly want and need their experience and expertise in the marketplace. We are hurting our own businesses and our own organizations by having some of our senior statesmen go off into a 30-year vacation, a 20-year vacation. Having greater freedom, having greater ability, and not to mention for so many, there may be a physicality involved. There's a medical health. You can't work in construction at the same way at age 75 as you could at age 35, but still having some usefulness in other areas of life. And I think what we've done is not just take 65-year-olds out of the workplace. We've taught 35-year-olds that the purpose of work is to not do it anymore. This entire retirement context reinforces this message. They sell a business successfully in their 30s and then want to leave the workforce. Somebody who sells a business in their 30s for enough money to not have to work anymore, we desperately need working. They surely have some sort of entrepreneurial giftedness that we want their second attempt, their third attempt. So that chapter is purposely very critical of the entire idea of retirement that would remove some of our best and brightest from the marketplace.
Work-life balance is a topic we've heard a lot about in recent years. What is your take on that? So the chapter that I'm referencing here is entitled Imbalancing Act, Our Obsession with Work-Life Balance. Are we paying too much attention to the give and take, even by maybe just dividing them into two different worlds, that we think about, you know, we have this work world life to balance and this home life to balance. Is our mistake in just the approach of how we're implicitly in that thinking about it, that these are two things that we have to balance in a certain way?
I'm not sure it's implicit. I think the very term is explicit. Work and life balance mean they're two different things that somehow need to be balanced. Even apart from, I think, the logical problems with believing it's a yin and a yang that have to be somehow asset allocated, we fundamentally are misdefining life to talk about a work and life balance. I think work is part of our life. And I state very clearly, can you imagine saying to a spouse, listen, honey, I need to figure out how I'm going to balance you with my life. At some point, the two become one, and we accept this language in marriage, or at least we ought to. But with work, I believe that the language of work-life balance is offensive and anti-biblical. But a work-rest paradigm is very different than a work-life balance. I am not trying to balance various hobbies, habits, and enjoyments and recreations in my life with work. But I, like anybody else, I have to run a schedule every day. It's going to include a lot of responsibilities. It's going to include chores, some things I like doing more than others. But nevertheless, this is part of our life. The way in which Scripture talks about this subject is very meaningful, very helpful, and it's also exclusive. It's all there is. God works 6 days and rested, for one. He provided a concept theologically, without getting in the weeds of what a sort of Sabbath theology ought to look like. He provided an order, because he loves us, for us to rest 1/7 of the time, which happens to be exactly what he did from the creation of the world. So I believe that we need to have a paradigm that calls for work and rest, and within our daily responsibilities, we're navigating a lot of things. It's much more seasonal than it is day by day. But where work-life balance language comes from is a presumption, mostly to a coddled and infantilized younger workforce, that somehow they have a birthright to certain amenities and privileges in entering a young career that are entirely untrue and very unproductive for what we're trying to generate.
How important do you think rhetoric and the way we talk about these things is? Because I go back to Deirdre McCloskey's great bourgeois values, economic histories. Yeah. And one of the big takeaways from that is, you know, is I remember hearing Deirdre do this presentation about like the hockey stick of human progress, right? That we're really just middling along and less than a dollar a day for all of humanity. And all of a sudden, at one point in like the 1600s, 1700s, it explodes. And she points that to people started talking differently. The rhetoric around things like entrepreneurship, commerce changed. And it resulted in this, in her argument, this huge explosion in wealth, increase in well-being. A couple of these things that we pointed out, right? The way we talk about vacation and retirement, the way that we talk about work-life balance. How much has the way we talk about these things, the rhetoric we use, kind of infected our understanding of work and its relationship to us as human beings?
It's a perfect tee-up to one of my obsessions in modern life, which is the notion of either creating virtuous cycles or vicious cycles. I talked about it earlier, a positive feedback loop or a negative one. The language matters a lot, and the language reflects the attitudes, and then the attitudes end up reflecting the language, and it really will spiral. So I'm utterly convinced that talking about things, for example, like work-life balance, it is dualism. By any other word, and in a lot of ways, it's Gnostic. We talk about, especially in the church, when people say things like, hey, are you going to work today? Or are you going to come do ministry with us? You know, why don't you retire from your work and focus on ministry? Get into a church committee, missions, help build the orphanage, things like that. All things that are very good, very important. But it separates some sense of a spiritual realm and a material realm in a way that is, I think, a byproduct of the Gnostic heresy. And that closet Gnosticism becomes a way we think, a way we speak, and then ultimately a way we act. The rhetoric matters. And it really comes down to why I titled the book Full Time. One of the best-selling books in Christian history on this subject was called Half Time, Moving from Success to Significance. And there's a whole chapter in the book where I critique that book in particularly, but there's no doubt in my mind that that mentality is not just the language. It's the language that leads to thinking, that leads to an action. And I think it's entirely wrong. I do not believe our work represents a period to become successful so we can then go do significant work. I think the work is significant. I don't think our life is a halftime where we do this material realm stuff for part of the time and focus on the spiritual realm for the second half. I think that we are to be engaged in our work, our vocation, our calling, our career, full time. And that is where that title really came from.
David Bahnsen, thank you so much for joining us. I want to recommend to everyone David's new book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life. David, thanks so much for joining us for
this
conversation.
So thank you, Eric.
As always, thank you for listening. Our team loves putting this podcast together for you. It's encouraging to hear from our listeners. Feedback is incredibly important to us because it lets us know what you'd like to hear more of, including the kinds of topics you're interested in most. If you have comments, feedback, or ideas for a show topic or interesting guest, you can email our team at producer@acton.org. Until next week, for Acton Line, I'm Eric Cohn.